This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
Good afternoon and welcome to Seminar B, Where Do Good Qualifications Come From? Greg Watson, who is Chief Executive of OCR, will be speaking. Greg became CEO of OCR in 2004 and OCR, as many of you know, is part of the Cambridge Assessment Group, which offers examinations and qualifications in 150 different countries. Greg joined OCR in 1998, and he spent 3 years as the first marketing and sales director before becoming deputy CEO in 2001. He sits on the governing body of the Joint Council for Qualifications, which is the umbrella organisation for major UK awarding bodies. He graduated from Cambridge in 87 in modern languages and worked for 10 years in the oil industry in retail and business-to-business sectors, covering marketing, business development, IT, systems development and quality management. His presentation today is going to take about 25 minutes and then we will have a discussion for the rest of the session, which finishes at 10 past 2 and I will try to finish promptly. Without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Greg. Thank you for coming, Greg.
Thanks.
Well, good afternoon. And I'll confess I feel slightly inadequate doing this, having heard Robin Alexander this morning. You know, I'm not going to be able to claim a three-year project back to 2006 and thousands of submissions and emails and all the rest of it. What I will claim is a little bit over 10 years in the qualifications business. More importantly, I think I'll claim a dialogue that runs the whole time between particularly those of us in the UK who do develop qualifications, and I compare notes regularly with other organisations that do similar. What I'll give you, I'll confess, is a bit anecdotal. It's based around some individual case studies, but I hope it is illustrative of the general theme of today, which is about where the state can and can't be helpful in a major realm of public policy and the sort of effects that it can have on education and on young people in particular. So I hope you'll take it in that spirit. I promise you, if you really like it, I'll start now and I'll publish a proper big book about it in 3 years' time. I thought it might be helpful, just by way of beginning, really, to define our terms here. What do we think a qualification is? And I think, rather than take a dictionary definition, what have I come to understand a qualification is? Well, for me, it's a portable record first. It is something that travels and has some value over time. Of knowledge or skills acquired, and you can play a lot with the semantics about knowledge and skills and many other things that might be claimed to be embodied in that record. Independently and fairly assessed. I think it's an important principle that it has some kind of independent standing that perhaps a claim on a CV, for example, wouldn't have. Assessed then to a defined standard, so actually it is a form of measurement and it's something that has its value from the application of a measurement consistently over time. Valued for certain purposes, I think that starts to connect it with some other people then who are going to ascribe value in recruiting for jobs, in admitting to university or further education courses, and importantly, it's by someone else. There's an important principle in a qualification that it's a process by which somebody who is not the individual who bears the certificate creates the value that is inherent in that certificate. And I think that's a reasonable sort of working definition of what we're talking about. So the next question is, well, who's a qualification for that? Who does it actually belong to in the end? And I suppose, if you wanted a sort of crude, obvious answer, well, it belongs to the learner. It belongs to the person who has acquired these knowledge and skills. They're the person who intends to kind of carry it with them through life and intends to use it to open up opportunities. And, in this increasingly sort of parentally engaged world that we're in, with so much discussion about parents taking a more and more active role and the great impact that can have on young people's learning, perhaps the parent also holds a bit of a stake in that. So you can say at one level, it's for a learner because they're the ones who are going to use it in the end. But that in itself is not sufficient. That doesn't meet my definition. So, there's also then an important stake for their place of learning. And I say school or college. I mean, I think you could just as easily say workplace. I was just in a seminar earlier that was talking about vocational education. There has to be some role in it for the person who's going to try and support and aid that learning It has to be something that they feel will be worthwhile. And, of course, very often, if you're talking about a school or a college, yeah, they're not in the business of supporting people to achieve individual qualifications. They're trying to support an individual to learn in the round. They have a curriculum that will have all, you know, many different aspects, some of them certificated, some of them not certificated, and they will own a qualification to the extent that it supports their school or college's aims and ethos and curriculum. And I think they have an important role, therefore, to play in giving some meaning to a qualification. But that, again, in itself is insufficient. That just leaves you with a learner holding a certificate, you know, to which they're which they're encouraged to achieve through a school or a college or some other place of learning. The qualification only ultimately acquires that lasting value that I talked about at the start because someone else is willing to ascribe value to it. And that means then there has to be some stake in that qualification from an employer who will regard it as a reasonable proxy for a set of skills, or a university that will regard it as a good, as a reasonable proxy for being ready to study a given university course. And it may well have need some value ascribing by some sort of expert community, a subject community that recognises it embodies the best of current knowledge in that subject, a skills community that has a particular interest in those kind of skills and making sure that they're embodied in the qualification that claims to be a measure for it. So I think there's a sort of golden triangle there, and a qualification actually in the end isn't really owned by anybody unless it's owned to a degree by the people on the three points of that triangle. And in that world, I would describe OCR and other organisations like OCR and Cambridge Assessment's other awarding arms as sitting somewhere in the middle of that triangle and acting as the certificator. And I think, aiming in certificating anything to be sure that what we're certificating is ownable by a learner, by the place where they're going to learn, and by whoever's going to ascribe value to what they've learned at the end of it. So that's a fairly simple model, and that takes us through in the history of UK qualifications to about 20 years ago, I think. And then you see a dramatic shift, and I think it's something that's already been signalled this morning by Simon Liebus and then also by Robin Alexander. There's been a very distinct shift over about 20 years then in education generally and in the instruments through which education is guided from on high. And qualifications have been no exception to that. So we now have qualifications not simply serving the three corners of that triangle, but also acting as a tool of macroeconomic policy. It was unmissable, touring party conferences really, to hear how much talk there is about skills policy now as a big kind of lever for improving the lot of the nation. It's become a measure of institutions and their teachers, league tables, parental shopping websites, almost as I would describe them, based on the outcomes of qualifications. And then you move beyond that, and by degrees, then qualifications have become a measure of the minister's success. Has the latest policy succeeded, as evidenced by different outcomes in qualifications, or take-up of new qualifications? And then beyond that, as the minister finds himself or herself at the international conference, comparing levels of achievement, levels of skills, and trying to find measures of international competitiveness, it also leads to a sort of a position in a ministerial league table, and all sorts of equating of different qualifications from different countries to try and discover who's got the cleverest, the most skillful learners, and who's got the most successful institutions for delivering learning. I think it goes beyond that then. Also, qualifications, I think, have become, in the same way as the curriculum and prescriptions about pedagogy, I think prescribing qualifications through various government mechanisms has also become some sort of means of protecting the learner from the worst a teacher could do or the worst a school could do to them. Somehow, if we tie the qualification down to within an inch of its life, nobody can possibly teach somebody the wrong thing that won't have value later on in life. And, of course, last but not by no means least, it's become a real focus for the media in the UK. If you want to criticise education, you criticise the qualifications. And I think you saw that with the criticism last week from Terry Lee here of Tesco, who actually talked about what he regarded as shocking standards in schools. But it was very quickly interpreted as being some kind of attack on the qualifications system and some kind of shortcoming in GCSEs, I think. Which, if you read very carefully, wasn't actually what he was saying. So we've progressively seen the sort of invasion of what was essentially a private space between learner, school and college, and employer and university, I would argue, to now actually be to see qualifications being used as a means of doing all these other things as well. And the effect of that has been absolutely astonishing. And it'd be interesting to see how much of this weathers the current economic storm and the public spending crunch that will come. Is OCR's sort of interim regulator, Ofqual, recently did a study of the process by which qualifications are developed and run in this country, and came up with a couple of astonishing diagrams, which I think tell a story better than I could ever. And the first one just describes some kind of process for how sort of funding flows around the system. The second one actually maps everybody who is now involved in the development and running of qualifications in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. And if I say that the vast majority, each of those boxes is a different organisation, most of those bodies are government-funded, most of them are government-controlled, and each of them then has a whole sort of management infrastructure for its role in qualifications. I think you can see that we've lost a very simple triangle. And I might suggest that there are many potential distortions that sort of model will give you in the way that qualifications are designed. You heard from my CV that my background before this was in industry, it would have been unthinkable in the business I used to work in to develop a new product by this process. You would know by the sheer number of people involved in it, you were likely to produce a camel at the end of it. Somehow it seems to me that we've lost sight of that. But I think that embodies everything that I've just said. Yeah, as qualifications have attempted to serve more and more purposes other than their primary one, many new mechanisms and lots of new cost actually has been born in order to support the various influences that are now in play. So what I want to do now, okay, that's the sort of general background. What I'd like to do now is just talk about six little case studies, three of which I would regard as success stories, three of which I would regard as not success stories. And out of that, I think try to just draw some principles about what makes a good qualification tick or what makes for a wreck. As I said, I don't pretend this is a Robin Alexander type thorough survey. I may be accused of a degree of partiality in my choices, but I think at least they illustrate some interesting examples of what can work and what can not work. And the first, actually, winding back, I'm pleased that Sarah Caldicott's in the room from Cambridge Assessment here. Sarah will know this story much better than I do. If you go back to the late 1980s, there was a huge upheaval beginning in the workplace, and the typewriter was being replaced by the PC. And that created a very particular economic and social problem, which is that particularly a lot of women who'd taken time off to have children were attempting to return to work, only to discover that the typewriter wasn't there anymore. And thankfully, that very flexible, adaptable education system that we had, particularly the FE end, responded by throwing together some IT courses and actually teaching people the basics of word processing and such like. And actually out of that, what was then the RSA exam board, I think began to hear some repeating signals from those colleges to say that there's something quite important happening here. And then it was through the mechanism of an exam board that actually employers who ultimately needed to validate this came together and helped to specify a standard against which these skills could be assessed. That's an absolutely groundbreaking initiative. I think we've worked out now between now and then, and son of Clate, is still running today. I think about 3 million learners have been through Clate in its many variations. But I think the importance of that story was the extent to which it just brewed bottom up, as a problem in the labour market that just had to be dealt with. And I mean, actually, in many ways, had there been whether there was a qualification, or even if there hadn't been a qualification, I wonder whether actually further education wouldn't have picked that up and done something about it. The impact of a qualification, of course, was to give these sorts of skills a currency that they otherwise wouldn't have had, to make them very quickly portable for people. Many of those women returners would have been able to do the qualification, get back into a job, and perhaps subsequently move on to another job, carrying those skills with them in some sort of accredited form. So I think it's a lovely tale of bottom-up innovation. And I've been unable, actually, looking in much more recent history, to find anything that's grown on that sort of scale in the UK qualification system in the last 20 years. I guess my spaghetti diagram might suggest some of the reasons why that's the case. A much more recent example, then, my second one, and this goes to the beginning of this century. And the big trend here was that actually vocational education, which had largely been concentrated in adults around the workplace was beginning to move much more significantly down into earlier years in education, and actually not just below 19, but below 16 as well. There had been a failed government-sponsored initiative, the GNVQ, in schools, but that had rather come and gone, and it had suffered actually from the spaghetti diagram problem, which is that it had been through four iterations in its 10-year existence, and had just become more and more complicated as a result. So there was a response of sorts to that. Schools and colleges tried to deal with the gap that was there and an emerging need by trying to adapt things that had previously been built for adults. So things like BTEC qualifications that had a heavy degree of currency with employers were sort of cobbled into courses for 14 to 19-year-olds, not terribly successfully. And so OCR at that point actually decided that it must be possible to create something more relevant out of this. Move with the spirit of the times, if you like. And so actually worked in a very directly sort of consultative way. So on the one hand, OCR had a whole sort of consultation system based around schools and colleges to try and understand what that gap in the curriculum looked like, what kind of qualifications might fit that. And on the other hand, consulted with employers who clearly needed to specify some key things that these qualifications should cover. They weren't all that successful the first time round. An important part of this story is that some of the first iterations didn't really work that well, but the feedback was very direct, and I think OCR felt we'd better respond to that. So the second iteration came out quite quickly afterwards. And this actually has been the fastest growing set of qualifications in UK schools of the last 5 years. And one of these qualifications will be the second most heavily used qualification in UK schools this year, which is only sort of 4 or 5 years on. Pretty unprecedented rate of growth. So again, slightly different story, this one. This involved a more conscious effort, I think, than the CLATE example, to triangulate between what the learners and their schools and colleges would want versus what employers would say was important. But again, a great success in terms of rapid take-up, and increasingly, as we hear the feedback from schools now, in terms of the impact that it's having on developing skills in young people. And the last example, and this is a slightly more controversial example for people who are involved in the science area. I can see Jeff's smiling over here, not surprised. There's been a lasting concern about how successfully we engage young people with science, around about the ages of 14, 15 or 16. Doesn't seem to be a huge problem with those who've got their eyes set on being a scientist and going on to do A-level, and perhaps even university-level study. But there seems to be much more of a problem in engaging 14 to 16-year-olds, particularly boys, with some sort of level of scientific understanding, which seems to be important to making sense of the modern world. So OCR was involved in an initiative which started life in a university, actually up at the University of York, with the Nuffield Foundation, which tried to rethink how you might get 14 to 16-year-olds, particularly those who weren't hell-bent on a scientific career, to make some sense out of science. And really that was less about creating a qualification. It was more about rethinking the approach to teaching. It was a way of taking a lot of the existing content in the science curriculum and structuring it a different way and supporting it with a style of teaching that connected it more directly to the real world that these young people could see. It went through a genuine 2-year pilot and a very, very thorough evaluation, out of which some very good lessons were learned. But the number one lesson was that actually this different approach to teaching had all the right effects. And there were widespread reports that particularly young boys seemed to stick with science and see some meaning in science that that wouldn't have done under the previous approach. The other thing is that, OCR particularly took away from it, is that teachers need a lot of support because this was a different approach to teaching. And teachers who've been teaching for a long time by a particular method needed actually quite a lot of support in trying out some different approaches in a way that didn't feel too risky, didn't feel too uncertain. That actually turned into a great success. When this was launched as a in its final version as an OCR syllabus, it rather took the country by storm. Large swathes of schools that had been very stuck on a traditional model of teaching science switched across to this approach instead. I think the important thing about this particular case study was this was all about teaching. This was nothing to do with qualifications and assessment and standards and structures. It was actually simply about finding a way to get the qualification described in a way that was supportive of a different teaching approach. And actually, the role that the qualification played, I would argue, is it legitimated that approach to teaching that otherwise a lot of teachers would have thought was just too big a risk. So three quite interesting and very different case studies there. There's one that's all about something bubbling up in the labour market, one that's something about schools trying to fill an emerging gap in their curriculum, and then there's one here about a long-established subject and somebody sort of grappling for a different pedagogical approach which qualifications could give some sort of licence to. Okay, that's the good news. Now, let me tell you three little horror stories now, by contrast. I know about this one because I was personally on the wrong end of it as a trainer in a PLC at the time that MVQs were first emerging. So this is early 1990s, and I think this is one of a series of very really pretty heavyweight government initiatives to try and get skills moving in the economy. I think there's a feeling that we're falling behind, that we're gravitating towards low-skilled jobs, and the idea was for MVQs to give a shot in the arm to skills right across all sorts of areas of economic activity. But the mechanism here was very much a top-down one. In fact, you'll see some of the bodies that were born in this era on the spaghetti diagram that I showed you. And the particular bodies were sectoral trade bodies that were asked by government to define competence standards, which could then be used as the basis for qualifications. Yeah? So for the first time, you've got quite a large amount of taxpayer funding, if you like, given to a body, which is given the absolute authority. There was also quite early on the emergence of a common template. The idea of, sort of units and whole qualifications became a stricture within which each of these bodies had to work. And the end result of that was actually a set of specifications, a set of really kind of very complex syllabuses, which were very difficult for learners to navigate, and even tougher, and that's where I was involved, to deliver if you were a trainer or a manager in a business. And I had the particularly bizarre personal experience of trying to train a group of salespeople in a large company. And these were all reasonably capable people. So they had some of the skills already. They were trying to fill in some of the gaps. But if you'd asked them to describe their own jobs, they would probably describe three or four major building blocks. In order to achieve the qualification we were after, they had to complete 13 separate units and 13 lots of assessment, which just proved to be very unworkable. And actually, as a result of a lot of that sort of complexity, many, many sectors dropped away quite early from this and reverted to other kinds of qualifications. One or two sectors it did succeed, actually. It succeeded in hairdressing, construction industry to a degree. One or two sectors where there was a need to prescribe some sort of licence to practice, these things tended to last, and they've tended to go through lots of iterations to get them right. But I think it's very telling. It was the imposition of a lot of top-down structure that created the complexity that made it unworkable, that in the end disengaged a lot of the learners and a lot of the employers that for whom these were supposed to be built. Another example, slightly different, huge reform to A-level that was conducted with first teaching from 2000 and the first results coming out in 2002. Again, a big top-down policy drive, all about moving all A-levels to a common new structure, which was a modular six-unit structure. This represented a very dramatic move in terms of the amount of decision-making that moved to Whitehall as compared to previous developments. Thinking back to sort of what Simon said about Kenneth Baker saying, my writ doesn't run to X, Y, and Z. He's certainly in those days, if he'd been asked, he wouldn't have said his writ ran to describing the internal structure of A-levels. And yet by about 2000, you found that ministers were actually intimately involved in the design of units, in the weighting of those different units in the whole qualification. And again, arguably, it produced a lot of complexity, quite a big burden on schools. And there were quite a lot of complaints from day one almost about how deliverable this was in a school. I think it's arguable that schools and colleges particularly were kept very distant from that development. It was seen to be a sort of technical thing about the architecture of the qualification rather than the basis for good learning programmes. And the end result of all of that, which, I mean, many in the industry will know this, this is one of those moments in history. At the time, I think a lot of people said this was all about assessment and standards. I actually believe in the end, the reason that 2002 turned into a big furore was there was an underlying lack of buy-in from many of the people who should have been supportive of that qualification. I think particularly schools and colleges felt that it hadn't been developed in a way that was really sympathetic to their aims and what they knew about teaching and learning. And I think it was almost inevitable that at some point then that frustration would blow up, and it blew up actually when the first results were published in 2002. And last but by no means least, I think a very, very current example now. I call it early in the century, I suppose. Yeah, by the end of the century, people will be looking back and writing the real history of diplomas. Again, big top-down initiative in government. I think a belief that vocational, work-related, skills-based education is becoming so much more important for 14 to 19-year-olds. And so, here again, a further development of the government's role in directly specifying what's to be taught and what's to be assessed. Rather like the MVQ example that I quoted, then you have government bodies, in this case diploma development partnerships, commissioned to act as representatives of the employer community, representatives of higher education. But the distinguishing feature of the diploma development then has been that effectively those diploma development partnerships started by writing the curriculum and then moved on in a linear fashion to try and describe the assessment arrangements for the curriculum. And then very late in the day, before these things emerged into schools and colleges, there was some work then on how these things were to be taught. Again, I think characterised by a lack of, or at best a very late involvement of schools and colleges and their teachers, which I think has had a predictable result. I think these things have turned out to be fiendishly complex to deliver on the ground, however laudable the curriculum aims might have been, and however enlivening some of the content could have been, given that it was produced by real employers and real universities. And it's fair to say, I think everybody involved in the diploma programme so far in the UK would recognise take-ups being far lower than expected, and I think much of the reason lies in that very complexity. So I'm going to skip over a couple and just move on quickly to the end, because I'd like time for some discussion. If you go back to my original definition, a qualification inherently belongs to the person who's studying for it, the person who is teaching them towards it, and crucially, the person who's going to ultimately, or a group of people who might ultimately ascribe lasting value to it for the purposes of work or for higher study, or because actually this qualification has a particular role in a subject, in a particular subject domain, and that those experts provide their endorsement of it. So what do I learn from my case studies, three good, three bad? Well, the first thing is that actually in all the successful examples, it involved very careful trade-offs between those different stakes. In order for any given qualification to work, it does have to work for the learner, it does have to work for the teacher or the teaching institution, and it does have to work for the people who are going to give it currency. The second thing I take away is that actually it doesn't work if you develop curriculum, then assessment, then the pedagogy in some sort of linear, sequential fashion. Those three need to be in play right at the start. And a couple of the horror shows that I've described, I think, are the result particularly of leaving the pedagogical aspect until far too late in the process, where it was no longer possible to make some trade-offs in order to make the teaching most effective. Piloting seems to play an important role. In each of the three successful case studies, the early years were actually quite small, and things were allowed to take their natural course, and a bit of refinement was possible early on in response to early feedback, rather than a sudden dash for enormous growth at the start. I would argue, and I think there's a growing body, if I did have the time to do a Robin Alexander and look back over thousands of case studies, I can say without a shadow of a doubt that it's the building in of very high political stakes early on, creating a sort of dash for a lot of volume and a desperation to claim success early on that gets in the way of many of the trade-offs that need to be made, stops people collaborating most effectively, and stops things being piloted and evaluated early on in such a way that they can be refined and improved on into a second and third iteration. As often as not, actually, when the political stakes have been raised so high, if something doesn't succeed quickly, it's simply dropped to be replaced by a new initiative rather than improved upon. And finally, and I hope perhaps a sort of overarching message for much of what's happening at the whole conference today is that in future policy making, in the whole area of qualifications, and I might argue actually in the whole area of education, could do better in learning from success. It's sometimes the grassroots innovations. It's sometimes the one-off drive from somewhere to get something off the ground and try it out and see what happens that produces the biggest and most astonishing results, rather than the top-down sort of directive from Whitehall. And perhaps as we see some of the spaghetti and some of the costs associated with it dismantled in the coming years, as I think it inevitably will be, we'll have an opportunity actually to relearn some of the successes that I've talked about and replicate them to the benefit of everybody on whichever corner of that triangle they happen to stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.